On the clifftop balcony, Hobbs whooped with delight. Damn fine shot! Or, if I may say so, Vice Admiral, sir. Hobbs was leaning over the balcony, squinting. They can't shut the hatch! The cable! It's in the way! Ramsay felt suddenly very sick. Ordinary Seaman Mansell had poured an entire drum of HCN into the water system, but he wasn't quite sure what he should do next. His hands were shaking. Joining the Navy early had seemed like a good idea. Now he missed his mum. Only Donna had shown any understanding or compassion, and he wished she were here now for him to talk to. He suddenly froze as he heard footsteps in the corridor outside, but they weren't the shuffling footsteps he expected. And there was singing, too. Ave Maria. And the voice was familiar. Commodore Jarman. Mansell gently opened the door and watched as Jarman disappeared into the shadows ahead. Deciding he was being utterly foolish, but had no choice in the matter, he began to follow. Deep within the war tunnels, the hydrocyanic acid spread through the water system. As it hit the masses of tiny, writhing nemonites, it caused devastation. Clayton stood alone in a darkened stairwell, watching as the bodies of his children were washed lifelessly out of holes in the shattered pipes. There was a sickening stench of almonds filling the air, and it choked him. Furiously, he threw his head back and howled in anguish. The doctor finished lashing up the last of the lights in the operating theatre. "That's it now to find Clayton," he said, and stood up, brushing his suit down. And then a terrible wail echoed through the tunnels. It was possibly one of the most heartbreaking sounds the doctor had ever heard. Frowning sadly, he raised the sonic screwdriver and activated it. The tip glowed an incandescent white, and waves of high-pitched sound burst from the device, throbbing and pulsating throughout the war tunnels. Clayton's howl of agony ceased abruptly as the waves of sound hit him, almost knocking him off his feet. With a snarl of anger, he cocked his head to one side, working out where the sound was coming from, and then he stalked purposefully away into the shadows. The doctor switched off the sonic screwdriver and smiled to himself. "If that doesn't bring you running, then I'm a monkey's uncle," he paused. "Or is it Bob's uncle?" He crouched down by the crude transformer he had cannibalized from various bits of equipment lying around and patted it. Still no power. And if his plan to stop the Nemonites was going to work, then he needed lots of power, and urgently. Jarman found he didn't need the keys he had stolen from Ramsay's room. The door had been smashed partly off its hinges. The Nemonites must have destroyed the door when they cut the power to the base. Stepping inside, he shone his torch over the massive generator that sat lifelessly in the centre of the room. Smoothing the ruffled jacket of his smart new uniform, he moved to the main control panel and began examining the dials and levers. Ordinary Seaman Mansell moved out of the shadows, confused as to why Jarman was dressed in Ramsay's uniform. And why had he let himself into the dynamo room? Something was seriously wrong. He stealthily began to make his way back towards the operations room. Inside the U-boat, Fosbrook and Donna had managed to find a length of rope and tied the hatch shut. They clung to the ladder, listening to the angry snarls as Sharpington struggled to get inside. "What are we going to do?" Donna asked. "We've got to get that power on." "I don't know. You're the one with the brains. You tell me." "Can't we..." she began. "I don't know. Can't we electrify the hatch or something? We've got the power already and waiting." Fosbrook's eyes gleamed with inspiration. "You are brilliant." With that, he dived back down the ladder, leaving Donna to bask in adoration. "Twice in one night. That's genius." At first, Clayton didn't realise the doctor was there, waiting silently in the darkness, his feet resting on the operating table. But as he stepped warily into the operating theatre, the doctor cleared his throat and stood up.
"You took a bit longer than I thought. Been busy."
"What did you do to my children?"
The doctor looked confused.
"You have butchered my children,"
Clayton said angrily, spitting black saliva. The doctor held up his hands.
"Whoa there, whoa. No, not me. I wouldn't do that."
"Your hands are ingrained with the blood of thousands."
Clayton began to circle him, eyeing him suspiciously. The doctor backed away around the operating table. I'll make you a deal. I'll take you home if you agree to leave this world in peace. Clayton paused.
Not now I've seen this world. It's beautiful. Perfect. So perfect.
But it's not your world, pleaded the doctor.
Species come and go.
If you go back, it's not impossible to coexist with other inhabitants, the doctor began.
Clayton roared.
It was our world. They were the invaders. They came to terraform my world, to colonize. We were an inconvenience. Disposable, we were forced underground.
He moved towards the doctor once more, this time with his hands outstretched, palms upwards, almost pleading.
Then they came to cull us. They call themselves pioneers, butchers. My people were slaughtered in their billions. Only a few of us escaped. I hitched a ride inside the body of one of their crew, and I made it to their home world.
Where I found you before you escaped into the vortex, the doctor said. Clayton nodded.
Alone.
The tiniest of tears rolled down his cheek. The doctor said softly, I'm truly sorry for what's happened to your people. I lost my planet too.
3, 2, 1, yelled Donna. Now! Fosbrook closed his eyes tightly and threw a switch on the fuse board. There was a brilliant yellow flash of light, followed by a deafening bang. Above them, a pall of smoke billowed into the hatchway, and from outside there came the sound of something heavy falling. Turn it off! Donna yelled, and they both tore up the ladder. Sharpington's body lay outside the hatch, his hands blackened and charred by the intense jolt of electricity. The Nemanite lay next to him, twitching feebly as it slowly died. Donna grimaced. That is just nasty. Fosbrook jumped over to the switching box. Ready to save the world? He asked. Donna put her hand on his and smiled at him. Too right, she said. Together they pushed the main lever. Suddenly, in the operations room, the banks of communications equipment burst into life and some of the emergency lighting returned. Clutching his arm, Hobbs staggered to his feet and grinned. Ramsay leapt from his seat. They did it! Give them a ruddy big medal! He turned to the nearest radio. This is Vice Admiral Ramsay. Come in, HMS Brazen. I repeat, come in, HMS Brazen. A crackling voice came over the radio. This is HMS Brazen, receiving you loud and clear, Vice Admiral. Ramsay gave an enormous smile. There is no one in the world I don't love right now. In the operating theatre, an indicator light began to blink on the doctor's rickety transformer. Brilliant, he thought. The power's on. He turned to Clayton. Your home planet, Sathutha Logal, has a really tiny sun, so tiny, in fact, that the planet hardly has any light at all. And you find bright light rather painful. No, correction, intensely painful. So, agree to leave this world now, or I'll use this. The doctor held up his sonic screwdriver. You and your people can leave this planet peacefully with me. Clayton laughed.
Or you could join us with your knowledge, your ship, the two of us together. The possibilities are intoxicating.
The doctor leaned in close across the operating table, almost as if he sensed the intoxication. If a man could mount to heaven and survey the mighty universe, his admiration of its beauties would be much diminished unless he had someone to share in his pleasure, he said. Then his face hardened. Don't you just hate Cicero? Dreadful man, very bad breath. Anyway, I can take you home or I can stop you. Clayton's black eyes narrowed.
My surviving children are nearly ready to spawn. Do you know how many millions of us there will be then? We'll drain this world dry, move on to another and another.
Don't you dare! The doctor shouted. Don't you dare!
We can rip this world apart, cell by cell. The people will suffer a pain so intense. And it will be your fault, Doctor. Your responsibility.
The doctor grim-faced raised the sonic screwdriver, pointing it at the transformer. I'll use it, he warned.
Then use it, Clayton bellowed. Join those who have become butchers of our race.
The doctor's finger hovered over the activation button. He was in torment. For once, he was powerless. Ramsay spoke into the radio, knowing he had the full burden of history on his shoulders.
You have the full authorization of your Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill. With immediate effect, begin Operation Dynamo.
Then, his voice softer, he added,
Captain, get our boys out of Dunkirk.
Clayton roared.
We will kill every one of you, drown you all in a sea of your own blood.
The doctor raised the sonic screwdriver.
Don't make me do this, he yelled.
Clayton raged on.
Stinking, murdering.
I'm so sorry, said the doctor.
The end of the sonic screwdriver flashed an intense blue and the transformer kicked into life. A brilliant flare of radiant white light exploded out of the operating theatre's lights. Clayton writhed in agony, shaking, screaming, convulsing. His eyes rolled up into his skull. The Nemonite began chittering fiercely, a barely audible distress call, but the doctor felt the sound waves in the pit of his stomach. Clayton's body thumped, shuddered, and shook. And then, in an instant, he threw himself at the doctor, roaring, spitting, hissing. The doctor stood firm, holding the sonic screwdriver up in front of him, blazing intense light. He screwed his eyes shut, hating every moment. Clayton froze mid-attack, black drooling slime sizzling over his chin, and in a frenzy he clutched at the creature wrapped around his throat. The Nemonite dropped from the back of his neck and fell to the floor. Its repulsive body shuddered and trembled as it dragged itself underneath the cabinet, its skin bubbling in the searing light. With a look of surprise, Clayton dropped heavily to his knees. Then he toppled backwards, his body exploding into dust. The doctor deactivated the sonic screwdriver, and the intense glare from the operating theatre's lights faded to nothing. From the corridor he could hear shuffling feet approaching from the darkness, reacting to Clayton's distress call. There was a soft chittering from behind the cabinet, and the doctor pulled it out from the wall. The Nemonite attempted to rear up on its hind quarters, but it flopped limply to one side. Within seconds, its body was racked by tiny spasms. The doctor knelt sadly down in front of the dying alien.
I'm so sorry, he said softly. If only you'd let me take you home.
In the dynamo room, Jarman slammed the generator hatch shut and turned the starter. The huge generator began whirring, slowly gathering speed, crackling with yellow sparks. He crossed to the ventilation shaft and shone his torch up into its cavernous maw. It towered above him, rising almost 60 meters to the surface. Clasping the torch between his teeth, he clambered a few feet up to a small gantry and settled himself down to wait. "You got any family?" asked Donna as she sat with Fosbrook on the conning tower, their feet dangling over the edge. The fog was beginning to clear and the sky started to lighten at the edges. Anyone special?
Living in Hope, he laughed. There used to be younger brothers and a sister, once. My family, they... I sent them to Cornwall thinking they'd be safe. Air Raid got them. It took weeks before they notified me. They couldn't identify. His voice cracked. Just me and my mum now.
Donna reached out and squeezed his hand tightly.
The sun will be up soon, he said. A new day.
Donna rested her head on his shoulder and gazed at the distant horizon. Ordinary Seaman Mansell entered the operations room and saluted.
Sir, it's the Commodore, sir.
Ramsay felt his heart sink.
Give me some good news.
He's broken into the dynamo room, sir.
No, that's not good news. Let's try again.
I think he's trying to interfere with the generator, sir.
Ramsay heaved a sigh.
And I thought today just couldn't get any worse.
Somebody might want to block that door off, said the doctor as he breezed cheerily into the room. There are about 20 Nemonites heading this way.
Mansell and Hobbs started to barricade the door.
Did you get through to the fleet?
Ramsay nodded.
Brilliant,
the doctor exclaimed. He put his hand on Ramsay's shoulder and said softly,
I'm afraid the chaplain's dead. I had to destroy the creature. He wouldn't have felt anything. He was already dead.
Thank you. Ramsay nodded slowly.
What about the rest of them?
We don't have much time, I'm afraid. They're nearing spawning time again.
Hold on, Doctor. Ramsay held up his hand. There'll be more of those things.
Yeah, the Doctor nodded. Didn't I mention that? Probably about 1 million more.
There was a moment of uncomfortable pause.
I just wish there was a way of getting more light in here somehow. What time is it?
He suddenly asked. Ramsay looked at his watch. 4:16. The doctor clapped his hands to his head, thinking furiously.
Think. What time does the sun come up?
Ramsay shrugged. 5:12. What are you thinking? The doctor began pacing up and down.
So we've got 30 minutes.
32 minutes, interjected Ramsay automatically. The doctor smiled.
Thanks. So if we could get the Nimonites outside just as the sun comes up.
Surely, doctor, these creatures won't simply stand around and wait to be frazzled to a crisp, will they now?
Donna would have a better idea.
The doctor's eyes suddenly widened.
Donna? Where is she? I thought I told her to stay here.
Still on the U-boat with Fosbrook, I imagine, Ramsay said.
The U-boat? Of course! I just have to contain them in that. How?
The doctor bounced up and down, full of energy.
Infrasound! Clayton did it, so why can't I? I can use my sonic screwdriver to send out an infrasound wave. Mimic a Nemonite distress call. The Nemonites will hear it and they'll come running. Well, shuffling, but you see what I'm saying. We're going to lure the rest of these things outside the base, into the harbour and onto the U-boat. Take them out to sea and at least they're contained. Oh, yes.
Only one thing, said Ramsay. The main entrance is blocked. Remember? Mansell nervously raised his hand.
We've got dynamite in the stores, sir.
And we could get a bomb on that U-boat, Ramsay pondered. You can't just kill an entire species, snapped the doctor.
And how many more of my men will they kill? Ramsay said.
I can take them somewhere else, said the doctor. If I can materialise the TARDIS around that U-boat, I can take them all out of here. With sudden cracks, light bulbs exploded all around them. Those that hadn't exploded flickered and strobed.
A surge from the generator, groaned the doctor. It's overloading.
Jarman, Ramsay said grimly.
Right, you lot, pull yourselves together. I want you to do as the doctor says. I want these stinking alien things off my base. Mansell, go and blow our way out of here. I'm going to have a quiet word with Commodore Jarman. Well, come on, move it.
The doctor grabbed Ramsay by the arm and smiled at him. I want you back safe and sound, you understand? You've got D-Day to sort out.
D-Day? Ramsay queried.
Sorry, the doctor's eyes widened. Did I just say that out loud?
Hobbs and Mansell stood outside the explosive store looking glumly at the padlocked barring them from entry. Mansell started rifling through his pockets.
I've got a penknife somewhere. Maybe I can pick the lock.
Hobbs grinned.
Pick the lock? You're not in the army, lad. You're in the navy.
His boot splintered the wooden door. Vice Admiral Ramsay quietly stepped into the dynamo room, but stealth was not necessary. The generator drowned out every sound. He crossed to the control panel, but quickly snatched his hand away. Everything was hot, and the feeds to the battery room were registering a dangerous overload. So that was Jarman's game, he thought. Overload the electricity storage units and blow the war tunnels sky high. He began to switch off the power unit by unit, unaware of Jarman watching from the shadows. The explosion at the main entrance reverberated like thunder, clogging the tunnel with thick, dusty smoke.
Oh, well done! Yelled the doctor as he crawled out from behind a concrete stack.
As the smoke cleared, he could see the quayside in the distance. Mansell and Hobbs slapped each other on the back.
Right, Hobbs, you come with me. Mansell, I need you to fetch the patrol boat with the TARDIS. You need to be ready to pick us up. You understand?
They nodded. The doctor adjusted his sonic screwdriver and activated it.
Nearly there. Just drop it down a touch and bingo! Clever, eh?
He beamed at the two ratings.
Is that it?
Hobbs asked.
I can't hear anything, Mansell agreed.
It's infrasound, the doctor chided. It's not consciously perceived by the human ear. You just feel it.
Just wait till you get surround sound in cinemas. I promise you, you'll love all that subwoofer action.
They looked blankly at him.
Moving on, the doctor said.
I think we've got company. He gestured behind them.
Smothered by the shadow deeper in the corridor were the slowly advancing shapes of Nemonites responding to the distress call.
Donna and Fosbrook leapt to their feet as the sound of the explosion reached the U-boat.
A huge pall of smoke billowed from the main entrance of the war tunnels.
What's going on?
Fosbrook asked.
I'll give you one guess, two words, Donna replied.
The doctor!
From the cloud of smoke, three figures emerged, Hobbs and Mansell, and behind them, his suit flapping in the wind, was the doctor.
Donna leapt for joy, hugging Fosbrook.
They're out! Oh my God, she yelled. They're out!
But behind them, perhaps 30 ratings staggered into the morning air, obscene, swollen tails coiled round their throats and black slime drooling from their open mouths.
Doctor! She shouted, wildly gesticulating. Over here!
Mansell watched as the Doctor and Hobbs reached the U-boat and then he tore away along the quay. As the Doctor reached the top of the conning tower, Donna slapped him on the arm.
Ow! He winced. What was that for?
Heading here, en masse, she pointed at the rating, shuffling towards them.
Who do you think you are, the Pied Piper? She said.
Now is not the time, Donna. Inside, all of you. In the darkened dynamo room, Ramsay was ripping the last of the cabling out of the control panel when a bullet ricocheted off the wall near his head. He ducked, panting breathlessly.
Jarman, he shouted into the darkness. What the hell are you doing? I'm your superior officer.
Jarman's voice echoed from the shaft.
These are my war tunnels. I am in charge here. You will resign immediately, or I'll have you shot. I am now Vice Admiral. Since when did the War Office promote Commodores to Vice Admirals? Quiet! You were promoted out of harm's way because you're a liability, an embarrassment, Ramsay told him.
With a scream of fury, Jarman leapt from the ventilation shaft.
That's a lie!
Ramsay stood up, looking him up and down, and began to laugh.
What's this? Make-believe? Dressing up games?
Can either of you sell this thing? Asked the Doctor, peering into the gloom of the U-boat.
I think I can, Fosbrook said. I trained on a British sub, shouldn't be too different.
Brilliant, the Doctor said. I want you to get to the front. The front? Fosbrook asked.
You know, the control area place thingy, where you pilot it from.
The bridge? Yes, there, and get us out to sea, now. Fosbrook touched Donna's arm and produced a crumpled letter from the inside of his jacket. Promise you'll deliver it. It's for my mother, if I don't make it. Promise me. Donna took the letter from him and said, Don't be such an idiot, of course you'll make it. Suddenly businesslike, Fosbrook pulled away from her and said, You get out of here. I'll be fine, I promise. Donna grabbed his head, pulled him towards her and kissed him. Fosbrook smiled tenderly at her. You are so beautiful. Donna tenderly thumped his arm. Get a move on, sailor boy. With a last glance at Donna, he ran towards the bridge.
Donna, the Doctor said, I want you to hide here. When the Nemanites are all on board, get out, close the hatch behind you. I'm not leaving you, any of you, she said forcefully. Donna, we don't have time to argue.
The scuff of feet on rungs alerted them to the Nemanites descending the ladder.
I'll draw them off, said Hobbs.
He snatched the sonic screwdriver from the Doctor's hand, winked at him, and then darted off into the bowels of the U-boat.
Oi, I want that back, the Doctor yelled.
The first Nemanite reached the foot of the ladder, and the Doctor clapped his hand over Donna's mouth and dragged her behind a large stack of pipes. He gestured for her to be quiet. The creatures filed past one by one, the fleshy bodies around their necks looking more swollen than ever. The Doctor and Donna waited in silence, their hearts pounding as more and more Nemanites filed past into the darkness, snarling and drooling. Finally, the last one disappeared into the gloom.
I counted 37, Donna whispered.
Me too, the Doctor answered.
Now go, I want you out of here. I'm not going. Oh, yes, you are.
Hobbs backed away along the narrow corridor with a sonic screwdriver held in front of him. The Nemanites followed. He just hoped he didn't run out of corridor. The huge U-boat engines kicked into life, the whole boat vibrating as it lurched away from the harbour wall. Donna prodded the Doctor in the side and grinned.
Not going anywhere now.
Get down, he yelled, as the power cable snapped off the control panel and whiplashed violently back up the conning tower in a flurry of sparks, disappearing out through the open hatch.
In the dynamo room, Jarman stood over Ramsay, the gun pointed between the Vice Admiral's eyes.
How dare the Navy promote you over me, Jarman spat. The uniform suits me so much better, don't you think? Your retirement calls, again, he smiled cruelly. Well, are you going to get up and fight or lie there and die?
The patrol boat roared across the choppy surface of the ocean with Mansell at the helm, the spray washing over the TARDIS. The visibility was improving now as the sun began to rise over the channel, and he drew alongside the U-boat and kept a pace with it. The engine noise inside the U-boat was deafening, and Donna could barely hear a word the Doctor was saying.
We have to find the bridge, the Doctor yelled, and get everyone out!
They stepped through another bulkhead door and found themselves inside a vision of hell. Dead ratings lay scattered across the floor, their bodies swimming in a slimy, black substance which was full of writhing nemonites. The creatures swarmed and slithered across the dried-out bodies, and the air was full of weird, chittering sounds. In the midst of all of it was Hobbs, lying prone amongst the creatures. They were feeding off him, and his body had visibly shriveled. Clutched in his hand was the sonic screwdriver, still sending out the nemonite distress signal. "They've spawned," the doctor said, carefully taking the screwdriver from Hobbs's hand. "We're too late. Donna, we have to go." She grabbed his arm. "Fosbrook,
I'm not going without him," she shouted. "Michael!"
Fosbrook turned to face her slowly, his hand still at the controls. Donna clapped her hand to her mouth in horror. A nemonite was curled around his shoulders, feeding from the back of his neck. He reached out a hand towards her.
"Join us. There's nothing to fear."
Just for a brief moment, their eyes connected, and she thought she saw a tear run down his cheek.
"Donna, we have to go," the doctor yelled, dragging her away. "There's a ladder ahead. Move."
"We can't leave him,"
she begged.
"He's one of them now. I can stop these things, but I have to get you out."
She reached the ladder and the doctor waited beneath her, watching her climb.
"Come on," he yelled.
All right, I'm doing my best."
Her hands grappled for the rungs as she hauled herself up, her eyes blinded with tears. Mansell watched as they emerged at the top of the conning tower and stood on the edge. The doctor held Donna by the shoulders and shouted in her ear,
"Jump!"
Mansell was gesticulating wildly, desperately pointing behind them, and she turned as Fosbrook, drooling black slime from his mouth, pounced on her, grabbing her roughly by the arms. She felt something whistle past the side of her head, and Fosbrook jerked backwards away from her. She spun round to see Mansell refocusing the aim of his gun once more at Fosbrook.
"No!"
she screamed and threw herself in front of him. As she did so, Fosbrook lurched at her again and shoved her roughly over the edge and down into the surging sea below.
"Thank you," said the doctor.
And Fosbrook, now barely able to control his limbs, stood to attention and thrust his arm upward in a clumsy salute. The doctor smiled and then turned and leapt into the water. Standing alone on the conning tower, Fosbrook reached behind his neck. He grasped hold of the nemonite and began pulling the creature away from his skin. The terrible, high-pitched screaming that he could hear wasn't the creature's, but his own. Ramsay lay on the floor of the dynamo room. The massive generator began to shriek as it overheated.
"Not long now, Bertie," Jarman sneered. "And when this place goes sky high, you and Dr. Smith will just be statistics, casualties of war. How fitting."
He suddenly jerked his arm and fired. Ramsay screamed, clutching his leg and rolling onto his back in agony.
"I'll have you court-martialed," he told Jarman through gritted teeth. "You've probably got all of 3 minutes to do it. Shame."
Crossing to the ladder, Jarman gave a tiny wave.
"Ta-ta!"
And he began climbing towards the surface. Ramsay dragged himself painfully over to the control panel and started tearing at the wiring. Mansell grasped Donna's hand, hauling her up and out of the sea. She collapsed onto the deck, coughing and spitting seawater. The doctor clambered up beside her moments later and lay on his back, breathing hard. After a moment, he laughed.
"Isn't this how we started the night?"
She wasn't in the mood for laughing.
"Where's Fosbrook, Doctor? Where is he?" she yelled. "We've got to get him out of there."
He went back inside. The doctor touched her shoulder to comfort her. "I'm sorry." Donna staggered to her feet and headed towards the TARDIS in the stern of the patrol boat.
"We've got to get him out of there, Doctor. We've got to."
Badly injured but now free of the nemonite, Fosbrook stumbled drunkenly through the smoky U-boat corridors. He lurched from wall to wall and his mind raced feverishly. He had to destroy the nemonites, and the only way he knew was to destroy the U-boat. He stepped onto the bridge and found himself ankle-deep in the black slime, surrounded by snapping leeches. As he began to wade across to the controls, he felt nemonites biting his skin and coiling around his legs. Ignoring the burning pain, he began preparing the submarine to dive beneath the waves.
Donna rattled the TARDIS doors angrily. We've got to go now. You can save them. You can materialize the TARDIS inside the U-boat. Get them out of there.
The doctor opened the door and tore up the ramp to the console, desperately flicking switches. The console popped and fizzed with tiny explosions as the machine grumbled into life.
Oh, don't let me down now! Don't! He shouted at the console.
Donna joined him and grasped his arm.
Hurry up, we need to go, Doctor!
The central column started to rise and fall, making choking asthmatic noises. The column stuttered and faltered, then stopped completely.
I can't! The doctor yelled. Nothing's working, it's still waterlogged!
Bowing his head, he took a deep breath and then looked up at Donna.
I can't save them, Donna. I'm sorry.
He hit the console hard in frustration. Donna's eyes welled with tears.
Please, Doctor, you have to help him.
The generator was shuddering and smoking alarmingly. Ramsay gritted his teeth and wiped the sweat out of his eyes with the back of his sleeve.
Come on, come on, he yelled.
He reached deep inside the control panel and his fingers found the thick rubber-coated main power cable. He closed his eyes and pulled hard. Screws popped and the cable jerked out of its socket. The generator started to slow down, the deafening scream subsiding. He leant against the control panel, his heart hammering and relief washing over him in waves. Hauling himself up on one leg, he hopped over to the metal ladder and looked up. Perhaps 15 meters above him, he could see a tiny figure heading for the surface. Jarman. Somehow, Ramsay had to stop him, and despite the intense pain in his leg, he began to climb. Fosbrook's hands grasped the bow plane tightly as he forced the U-boat to dive down into the depths of the channel. His eyes fluttered and dilated. He was struggling, fighting against the effects of the Nemonites that were swarming all over him. A voice snapped.
What are you doing?
Fosbrook turned. Hobbs stood behind him, a bloated Nemonite attached to his neck.
You're trying to kill us all!
Fosbrook laughed sarcastically.
There's nothing to fear!
Hobbs began raging.
Which switch? Which one? Take us up! Up!
Fosbrook's hand reached out across the panel and his finger found the torpedo firing controls and flicked a switch.
Outer torpedo door! Locked!
Ramsay was climbing the ladder with a vigour he thought he no longer had.
Jarman! He shouted. You're a disgrace to your uniform! Correction! My uniform!
The Commodore paused and fired down the shaft. Ramsay pulled his body flat into the ladder and felt the blast as a bullet harmlessly passed him by. Again, Jarman cocked the weapon and fired. This time the hammer dry-clicked on an empty chamber. Impotently, Jarman hurled the empty pistol down the shaft and it ricocheted back and forth between the metal walls. Then, grasping the edges of the ladder with his hands and feet, he slid down, slamming into Ramsay and almost knocking him from the ladder. His hands grappled for purchase on Ramsay's uniform, his eyes flashing with fury. The Doctor and Donna tore out of the TARDIS and peered over the railings. The U-boat had vanished beneath the waves, and all that was now visible was the foaming wake on the surface of the sea.
Doctor! Donna shouted. Surely there's something we can do!
The doctor slammed his fist down on the railings. He had never felt more powerless in his many lives.
You shouldn't have been brought back! Screamed Jarman. I should have been in charge! Me!
He swung a furious punch, but Ramsay ducked and Jarman overbalanced. He swayed precariously on the edge of the 18-meter drop. His hands gripped desperately onto Ramsay's uniform, his feet flailing for a grip on the ladder. For a moment their eyes met, Jarman's oozing, unbridled hatred. His fingers slowly began to lose their grip, the fabric of Ramsay's uniform sliding between his fingers.
Consider this a dishonourable discharge, said Ramsay, desolate.
He turned his head away as Jarman let go and plummeted into the shaft. Fosbrook lay spread-eagled across the submarine's console among the seething mass of Nemonites. He flicked up the torpedo arming cover and his finger hovered over the red firing button. Behind him, Hobbs was beseeching.
Have pity! Help us to survive! Please!
Fosbrook was crying now, elated and high, his mind full of images of Donna.
For my king and for my country! Shouted.
He pressed the button. The torpedo launched, hit the locked outer door, and exploded. The U-boat lurched, shuddered, and dropped. A wall of flame advanced along the decks in silent slow motion, incinerating everything in its path. The last of the Nemanites thrashed in the raging inferno, burning to ash in seconds. The boat's outer shell crumpled inwards before suddenly bursting out in a mass of seething, violent bubbles. Cold, wet, and unutterably miserable, the Doctor and Donna stood silently staring through the morning light at the dark rolling channel. A deep-throated roar and then a huge explosion burst up through the waves, cascading foaming seawater high into the sky. Donna stared, her face wet with silent tears. The Doctor took her hand and squeezed it. "Heroes," she said softly, squeezing back. "Bloody heroes." Deep beneath the waves, the shattered sections of U-boat plunged down to the seabed. Silent. Majestic. Beautiful. The sun had burnt off the early morning fog. Donna sat alone in the bow, staring out to sea. She was holding Fosbrook's letter to his mother in her hands. The Doctor suddenly stood up, pointed to the horizon and shouted,
"Look! Donna! There they go! 850 ships off to fetch their boys back! The miracle of Dunkirk! Marvellous sight, don't you think?"
Sure enough, the horizon was broken by the silhouettes of hundreds of craft of differing shapes and sizes heading towards France. She smiled and nudged the Doctor in the side. "That's beautiful.
That's history, that is, Donna. This was their finest hour. Brilliant."
He put his arm around her shoulders and pulled her close.
"I'm sorry. Fosbrook was a good man. I'm sorry you got hurt. I got you hurt. Without you, Donna Noble, without you, I wouldn't be half the man I am. You are wonderful and clever and fun and unique and tireless and determined and amazing and devoted and brave and the best, best company. Thank you."
Donna looked up at him and said quietly, "Thanks. You don't have to talk some rubbish." As the patrol boat came slowly back to harbour, the Doctor held Donna and carried on talking rubbish.
"Well,"
Ramsay greeted them as they stepped ashore.
"It's over,"
the Doctor said, his voice broken with emotion. Ramsay silently saluted, then turned and led them back towards the war tunnels, limping painfully. As they walked, he put an arm around Mansell's shoulder.
"You'll make a damn fine naval officer, Mansell, one day. You did well. Not bad for a youngster, especially one not even old enough to join up."
Mansell looked shocked and said timidly,
"You knew, sir?"
Ramsay smiled. "Of course I knew. I'm not stupid. Did exactly the same thing myself. Good show."
The Doctor and Donna stopped and looked out to sea.
"You all right?" the Doctor asked.
"Yeah,"
Donna smiled, putting on a brave face.
"No, but I will be."
"You?"
"Yeah,"
the Doctor repeated, then paused.
"No, but I will be."
Linking arms, they followed Ramsay and Mansell back into the war tunnels.
"Oh, you've got some serious decorating to do here, Vice Admiral," said the Doctor.
Donna stepped out of the TARDIS, holding Fosbrook's letter. She looked at the address. Franchise Street, Chesham, Bucks. It was now early June and the sun was shining. Summer had well and truly arrived. In the front of the garden of a modest terraced house, an elderly lady was uprooting vegetables.
"Take your time. I've got some repairs to do," said the Doctor.
He was a brave man. His mother needs to know that.
"You'll be fine."
"Thank you," she replied.
"You'll be brilliant," the Doctor said, beaming a big, broad smile.
Donna took a deep breath and began to walk across the road towards Fosbrook's mother.
We'll be right back.
Doctor Who, The Nemanite Invasion, was written by David Roden and was read by Catherine Tate. It was produced by Kate Thomas and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
Sometimes Harry Winter hated his job, and today was one of those days. Even though it was October and the days were supposedly shorter, he'd still been woken up at some ungodly hour to help out on the farm, which might involve feeding the livestock, milking the cows, mucking out the stables, or any one of the other million jobs he couldn't actually remember agreeing to do. Still, he couldn't complain. Not really. He was doing it all for his father, after all. Life hadn't exactly been easy on either of them since his mum had died. And they were managing to get through it all, somehow. Together. One day at a time. Though it never really helped when some of those days seemed to drag more slowly than others. Take today, for instance. Morning now seemed like a lifetime ago, and Harry hadn't exactly achieved a vast amount in that time. At least it didn't feel like he had. Not that his job for the day had been a particularly easy or exciting one. He'd been sent out to scour the fields, looking for stones and rocks. Anything that might help repair some of the walls around the farmyard. He'd even taken a wheelbarrow out with him, just in case he got lucky. But there wasn't anything out there to get lucky with. Just pebbles and grit and dirt. Nothing you could use to mend a wall. No, for a job like that, you needed something heavier, bulkier, more substantial. That's when it struck him. There was a landmark just outside the village, like a mound of rocks heaped together in the middle of nowhere. No one could ever remember why they were there, just that they were. Had been for as long as any of them could remember. Lucifer's Tombstone, they called it. For years now, it had been one of those strange sites steeped in local legend and superstition, swamped in the kind of stories conjured up to make an otherwise unremarkable, some might even say boring, little village seem somewhat more exciting than it actually was. At least that's what Harry Winter had assumed before today. As he trudged through the thick, sloppy mud beneath his feet, he could just about see the sun dipping away behind the hills ahead of him. Its golden glow slowly giving way to darkness. Somehow, an entire day had already passed him by, but he could still be quick. He knew where he was going, after all, and when he got there, he realized that the mound wasn't quite as large as he had remembered, so it would take him even less time to shift. If only he'd thought of this earlier. Harry started heaving the rocks across to the wheelbarrow as quickly as he could, placing them gently on top of one another, trying to make them balance somehow, but they never did. He never even noticed the earth stir beneath him until he went to shift the final layer, by which point it was already far too late. A hand thrust through the soil without any warning, cold and clammy, knocking him off his feet, its long claw-like fingers clutching onto the remaining rocks for support, as a second hand burst up, twitching alongside it. Harry watched in horror as some unearthly creature hauled itself up from beneath the ground, grunting and growling, watching him as it rose from its grave, covered in grime, reeking of decay. He tried to run, but couldn't. His legs refused to move. Then he heard the creature laughing, its aura flaring angrily above him, bathing them both in an awful crimson haze. The demon had been disturbed, woken from its tomb. And Harry knew then that this was to be his very last day on Earth. The day that darkness dawned. Doctor Who, The Rising Knight, by Scott Hancock. Read by Michelle Ryan. doctor's eyes snapped open and he woke with a start. He wasn't used to waking. He never normally slept. So it took him a few seconds to work out where he was. Or rather, where he might have ended up. He tried to remember what had happened to him, but his mind ached, his head throbbing with an all-too-real pain. What had happened to him exactly? His vision was blurred, but he could still hear voices muttering above him. People gathered together, studying him, talking in hushed tones like they'd never seen a man before. At least not a man like him. He could tell from the way their voices echoed that he was indoors, and he was pinned to the floor. He could feel a pair of strong human hands holding him down. Still, could be worse. At least the floor was quite comfortable, and they'd gone to the effort of lighting a fire. He could just about feel the heat from it, blazing away somewhere behind his head. Then the doctor's vision began to clear, and he found himself staring up into the faces of at least 7 officious-looking men, all dressed in a smart array of waistcoats and breeches. 18th century Earth, the doctor smiled. Got to be. But the men standing over him couldn't see why he was smiling. Instead, they just glared back at him, and the doctor felt his skin slowly begin to crawl. "It is risen," announced one of the elders, his eyes narrowing as he met the doctor's gaze. "Tell the townsfolk, our demon is finally awake." Not the best introduction in the world, the doctor thought. Not by a long way. "Nice to meet you too," he muttered. Three weeks had passed since the death of Harry Winter, and still it was night over the village of Thornton Rising. Not once in all that time had a new sun threatened to rise. Not even for a moment. No new days, no new dawns, only darkness. Ever since the night of Harry's death. Abraham Godchild watched with fascination as he rode towards the village. He watched as the day was swallowed up by darkness, pitting him against the vicious void of night. Just over a week ago now, word had reached London of the strange circumstances that had befallen Thornton Rising. That it had been consumed by darkness, cut off from the rest of the world. That no mortal man could enter. And so Godchild had found himself dispatched by His Majesty's officers to investigate. If such a thing was proven to be true, why, it could only be the work of the very devil himself. Thornton Rising would be removed from every map, its history struck from the records, post-haste. As far as the king was concerned, it would never have existed, and the entire area would be declared property of the crown, quarantined the second that confirmation reached his ears. And Abraham was determined not to let him down. Even now, as he rode across the moors, he cut a dashing figure in the night, and he knew it. Tall, fit, clean-shaven, foppish chestnut hair tucked neatly away beneath a fashionable tricorn hat. His clothes fashioned from the finest satins and silks. Truly a man on a mission. And a rich man at that. He had been selected personally for this task on account of his dedication and devotion to duty. A loyal servant who had repeatedly proven himself capable of keeping his head in difficult situations and who could hold his own against the common man. And yet, now that he was here, now he'd broken through that fabled veil of night, a shiver ran down his spine, a deathly chill he couldn't quite explain. It was almost as though something was deliberately allowing him to enter, luring him in, closer and closer. But it felt wrong somehow. He could sense it. Something in the shadows stalking him, studying him intently. Something that didn't correspond with his understanding of the world. Something alien. He slowed to a trot, the earth now wet and sloppy beneath his horse's feet. And once again peered ahead of him for any sign of the village. But there was nothing. No sign of life at all. Only night. An all-consuming darkness that devoured everything from sight. Everything except a tall, blue, wooden box. I told you I came here in the TARDIS, the Doctor insisted. Now all I want to know is how I ended up here. The voices around him grew louder, and the Doctor's simple request was drowned out in a sea of accusation. A myriad of voices demanded impossible answers from him, hurling their abuse, their words echoing off the walls of this makeshift prison. There could only have been about 10 different men in the room with him, the Doctor thought, though the frequency and volume of their accusations made it seem like there were hundreds. He looked up at the men, studying them all from where he lay. He could tell they were wary of him for some reason. Even though they had him as their prisoner, they were somehow terrified. What did they make of him, he wondered? What did they think he could possibly do to them? And why did they think he was any kind of threat anyway? Maybe a bit rude sometimes, but he was nice enough to people, usually. Of course, the biggest question right now was, why was he there at all? He hadn't meant for this to happen. Not that he could remember, anyway. As the Doctor fought for answers, he found himself bombarded with a million more voices, spilling out from every corner of the room all at once. What was he? Where had he come from? Why was he here? Was their Lord displeased somehow? The Doctor's brain strained hard to decipher all these questions, his mouth struggling even harder to answer them. And every time a new one was asked, the Doctor devised yet another to combat it. Then a single voice cut clearly through the darkness, and the room gave way to silence. All except the Doctor, who could still be heard blathering away to himself, just a second or two after everyone else had stopped. Gentlemen, the voice demanded, leave that man alone. There was a gasp from the crowd, and the Doctor grinned as he felt the two men pinning him down immediately relax their grip on his shoulders, hauling him up to a sitting position on the floor. Still, the Doctor couldn't see his rescuer. Then the voice spoke out again, trapped at the back of the crowd. Let me see him, she said. It was a woman. Young, yet confident, the Doctor thought. And from the initial reaction of his captors, clearly one they were already well acquainted with, for better or worse. He watched expectantly as he heard her footsteps approach, the crowd parting neatly in the centre, letting her through. Her short, petite frame a marked contrast to the tall, powerful bodies that surrounded her. Her clothes were simple and muted. A chocolate-brown gown closed over a lighter-coloured petticoat, complementing the long chestnut hair beneath her bonnet. She was probably in her early 20s, the Doctor guessed. Her face was still fresh and healthy, her figure slim. She stepped forward, taking the Doctor's hand in hers, pulling him up gently from the floor to his feet. Thank you, he whispered with a smile. But the woman didn't react. Instead, she simply looked the Doctor up and down, as though studying him, his manner, his clothes, his hair, when one of the older men abruptly stepped between them, blocking their views of one another. Charity, please, the man objected quietly, struggling to remain calm in front of the stranger. Charity, the Doctor grinned, interrupting their conversation with a yelp of approval. Nice name, I like it. The old man turned to face him, a disapproving expression across his face. Sir, I bid you be silent, he demanded, and immediately the Doctor did as he was told. Then he noticed Charity smiling at him, ever so slightly, just enough to reassure him. My dear, please, you know you shouldn't be here, the man continued. Won't you please return home and lock yourself away, for our sakes, if not yours? But already even the Doctor could see this man was fighting a losing battle. I thank you for your concern, Mr. Tully, Charity told him as she took the older man gently by the arm, ushering him back into the throng of men behind her. And yet I'm afraid I cannot do as you would ask, for I fear this man is not all that you believe him to be. Oh? The Doctor asked. No, Charity answered, shaking her head, turning round to face him. You disappoint me, sir, she smiled. They told me you were a demon. Really? The Doctor's eyes boggled now. Why would they go and say a thing like that? Because, sir, another man interrupted, you do not appear as any other man we recognise, and there have been no other men to arrive in this place, not for over a month now. Charity felt the frustration rising in her voice. Mr. Hopkins, please, she insisted, this man is not a demon. Then explain his clothes, another younger man demanded. My clothes? The Doctor objected. What's wrong with my clothes? Janis Joplin gave me this coat. They are strange, the man continued. Unnatural. All clothing is unnatural, Master Higgins, Charity pointed out. And strange as his apparel undoubtedly is. Oi, the doctor yelped. It does not automatically signify a demon. Charity paused momentarily, waiting for the men to settle before continuing. This gentleman could be any number of things. A demon, an angel, perhaps just another ordinary man like yourselves. The room fell silent, and Tully stepped back towards the doctor, more cautiously this time. Are you an emissary of our lord? He asked. Well, the doctor hesitated, looking to Charity for approval before he spoke. I'm here to help, if that's what you mean. Definitely not a demon, then, another man yelled from the back of the room. Nope, the doctor replied. Just the doctor. Then enlighten us, sir, Higgins demanded. Tell us how you came to be discovered on the moors. You found me, then? The doctor asked. But the men refused to comment. Tricky thing, amnesia, the doctor explained. The mind normally forgets things for a reason. You don't want to force it. Could do all kinds of damage if you did. Do not dare to mock us, sir, snapped Tully, who was by this point shaking quite unsteadily on his feet. Whether through anger or fear, the doctor wasn't sure. You must agree we have shown you due mercy and consideration up to now. Do not give us cause to reconsider our stance on the matter. It was then that the doctor realized how scared they were. All right, he agreed, closing his eyes. I'll see what I can do. And with that, he cast his mind back. Back to before he arrived in Thornton Rising. He remembered being alone in the TARDIS, travelling back from the fortress on Acropolis, when the ship's ancient engines ground to an impromptu halt mere minutes after it was plunged into the vortex. The whole of time and space at his fingertips, and the Doctor had landed on Earth. Again. As the TARDIS settled back into reality, the Doctor threw open its doors and stepped outside. Within seconds, his trainers had sunk a good inch or so into the thick, sloppy mud of the Yorkshire Dales, cold, wet raindrops lashing across his face. The Doctor wasn't impressed. He quickly retreated back into the warmth of the TARDIS console room, hauling his long, warm coat over one of his skinny pinstripe suits, trying his best to be practical. There had been a time, he remembered, when the rain would never really have bothered him, when he'd have strode headlong into any danger, in any weather, any time, any place. But that's when he'd had someone to impress. And now the rain just reminded him of Donna, of the night he'd taken his best friend home for the very last time. Back to Wilf and Sylvia. Even now he still wondered what she'd make of each new world he landed on. The things she might say, the things they might do. The doctor shivered at the thought. Couldn't help it. And wrapped the coat tightly around his chest as he stepped outside, pulling the TARDIS doors behind him. It was black, cold, his feet already drenched. He tried to work out where he'd landed, his eyes roaming across the sky, searching for something he might recognize, something that might give him that little extra clue to where he was. But there was nothing. No planets, no moons, no constellations, not a single star. A little bit odd, he thought. Even as he breathed, he could taste the air around him, a flavour he recognised. It was Earth, almost certainly. But there was a distinct lack of pollution if it was. Pre-industrial revolution, perhaps? Which probably put him somewhere in the 16th, maybe 17th century. Possibly even the 18th at a push. What do you reckon? He asked, patting the TARDIS affectionately on its side, when a slender hand had wrapped itself coolly over his shoulder, frosty breath slithering down his spine. Before he had a chance to turn, the doctor felt a second hand snaking along his neck, ruffling his hair, cold, damp fingertips grazing gently across his temples. There was some kind of force creeping into his mind. Instinctively, he realised what was happening and reached to rip the fingers from his head, to break the link, when suddenly he felt himself drawn deeper away from his own memories, away from reality. He was somewhere new. As the doctor struggled to remember, he felt new memories forming in his head. His thoughts shifting, perceptions changing, like he was in the mind of something else entirely. The Doctor could see the last few moments of Harry Winter's life played out again and again, over and over, as though he was looking out through someone else's eyes. The eyes of a killer. The Doctor could see Winter begging for his life, bargaining with a force that had no concept of mercy or compassion. That look of terror etched across his face, even in death. Only ever thinking of his father, hoping he might never disappoint. Then the Doctor saw it. A creature reflected in Harry's own eyes as he blinked. Just a flicker of the dark force he'd released. The same presence that was in the Doctor's mind. Right now. But the Doctor couldn't make it out. Not clearly. The image was too faint. Just a flash of pale skin, gleaming white beneath the moonlight. Fangs bared. A sinister grimace slicing across its face as it pounced. The young man scrunched his eyes up tight through terror. The image of his attacker lost beneath the screams. Then the Doctor saw another man riding across the moors to his death, his mind still trapped behind the creature's eyes. Only these weren't its memories. Not anymore. Whatever the Doctor was seeing, it was happening there and then, here and now. And there was nothing he could do to stop it. A sudden chill shot down Abraham Godchild's spine, like someone had just walked across his grave. He rubbed his hands violently together, a pitiful attempt to keep warm against the elements, when he heard a woman's voice ring out ahead of him. At least he thought he did. He paused for a moment, listening out, waiting for the voice within the void.
"Hello?"
he shouted, just loud enough to convince himself he'd tried. Then after a few seconds, when there had still been no reply, he started on his way once more. It could just be his imagination, Abraham thought, but he could have sworn it suddenly felt a great deal colder, bitter, almost, as if the very air itself had frozen all around him. Then he heard the voice again.
"Help me!" it screamed. It sounded like a woman lost on the moors. "Please won't anybody help me, for I am but a poor, feeble damsel in distress, unable to assist myself."
Immediately, Godchild leapt from his horse onto the muddy tracks below, stepping across the path in search of this damsel, a dashing gentleman to the rescue at last. "I'm here," he shouted as helpfully as he could. "Where are you?"
"Down here," the woman yelled again, and he followed her voice all the way to the edge of a slope, leading gently down into the valleys below.
She must have slipped, he thought. Easy enough to do on a night like this. He should probably tread carefully himself, come to think of it. He peered over the edge and could just about see her, clinging to the grass a short distance away from him. She was just a silhouette at that point, picked out against the landscape. Unnaturally thin, a woman tall and slender. Probably didn't have the upper body strength to haul herself back onto the path, poor thing. Still, she wasn't far away. He could probably reach her himself without too much trouble. He crouched against the ground. "Listen to me," he said, holding one of his hands out towards her. "I'm here to help. Now, I want you to grab my hand and hold on tight. Can you do that for me?"
"I think so,"
she said, clutching onto his hand in a vice-like grip.
A little less tightly, perhaps,"
Abraham suggested, as he dragged her back onto the path behind them, pulling her up with him as hard as he could. Then he lost his footing and slipped against the mud, yanking the pair of them down into a puddle in the path. Their clothes soaked, chests heaving, the cold wind whipping across their faces. She turned to him where they lay.
"Thank you," she said. "I could surely have never overcome such a gentle incline without your assistance."
"The pleasure was all mine," Abraham grinned back at her. "Good thing that I was passing through, though, eh?" She smiled a wicked smile.
"Wasn't it just?"
Abraham smiled at her again, and it was only now he found he could make her out more clearly. Almost as if she was allowing him to see her in the darkness. Long blonde hair cascaded across her shoulders, and her skin seemed to shine translucent, almost dangerously pale. The woman he'd rescued, his damsel in distress. And she was beautiful. But there was more to her than that. She was striking, yes, but he found himself strangely captivated, enthralled by her. He never even realised he was staring. Not that she'd have cared. Her gaunt and hollow face shimmered and glowed like a seraph in the night, her steel blue eyes sparkling brightly into his across the gloom,
like they could bore into his very soul somehow. And he could feel her now, forcing her way into his mind.